Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. Yesterday afternoon, I moderated a mayoral candidates forum at NYU, sponsored by their Furman Center and Mollis Institute for Affordable Housing. Affordable housing was the topic. The five major Democratic primary hopefuls were there, plus Independence Party candidate, former Bronx Borough President Adolfo Carrion. We'll play some excerpts in a minute. I'll start, though, by acknowledging the winner of our Rename the Mayoral Forums Twitter contest. Since there are so many mayoral candidate forums this year, the candidates told me yesterday that they're doing 20 in April alone. And forum is an inherently boring word to begin with. We invited our Twitter followers to nominate and vote on new names for this kind of happening. Some of the finalists and your creativity came through on our Twitter feed, as it always does. A Mayor Can Idle. Deaf Mayor Story Slam. Gracie Mansion Co-op Board Interview. And the winning entry from tweeter Ingrid Burrington was, "So you think you can mayor?" And so for one night, the traveling roadshow of mayoral candidates forums was called So You Think You Can Mayor. So with me now to play and discuss some excerpts is NYU law professor and Furman Center director Vicky Bean. She's a professor of public policy and law at NYU and helped put together the policy details of this forum. Professor Bean, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
I want to start with a historical soundbite that I referred to at the beginning yesterday. This is just 11 seconds of Mayor Bloomberg in a 2009 mayoral debate against Democratic nominee Bill Thompson in response to a question that I had asked in the New York One WNYC debate. I was surprised at his answer at that time when I asked, I guess the basic question was would education be his most important impact on the city?
The rezoning of this city will probably be the thing that has as much impact on the future of our city as the improvements in education.
So after 12 years of Michael Bloomberg, would you say, Professor Bean, that zoning and its impact on housing are that central to his legacy?
I think zoning is incredibly central to his legacy. There, the scope of the rezonings that the mayor undertook, really rezoning more than a quarter of the city's land, are a monumental shift. So it's a critically important aspect of his administration, and obviously very critically linked to the supply of housing that comes online in the next few decades.
And all the candidates yesterday said they would continue to zone to encourage housing construction to ease the city's chronic housing shortage. But I also asked the panel yesterday if they thought the Bloomberg administration had botched it in any specific neighborhoods, because there's always so much malcontent about rezoning in various places. And would they undo or redo the zoning anywhere in the city in particular? Public advocate Bill de Blasio and Comptroller John Liu are among those giving a direct answer to that. Here's de Blasio.
I, again, think Greenpoint Williamsburg and Park Slope rezonings were lost opportunities to create greater affordability. And I think it's both in how they were structured, but also in the enforcement of, in the case of Greenpoint Williamsburg, and the enforcement after the fact. How you get it fixed is a good question, but I think that those were glaring errors.
Anybody else?
I think there was a lot more potential in Red Hook, and also in downtown Brooklyn, where, you know, after years of promises of jobs and affordable housing, we do have a brand-new stadium, which looks great, but where's the housing?
So John Liu referencing Atlantic Yards. And what about the opportunities lost in Red Hook and then Williamsburg Greenpoint from de Blasio? Any thoughts about those neighborhoods in particular and why they were so contentious?
The critical thing here is actually to step away from individual neighborhoods and to think about the capacity that we're creating overall. One of the aspects of the Bloomberg administration's rezonings was that there were 120 of them, and it's hard to see the big picture. You can see neighborhood by neighborhood, but to stop and ask, okay, well, are we really creating opportunities for housing to be provided, or are we doing more downzoning, I think is a critical question. When we at the Furman Center put together all of the rezonings and combined them all and looked at the sort of 30,000-foot view, we saw that we really only created additional capacity for about 120,000 new units. And that's supposed to house or it's supposed to help house maybe a million new New Yorkers. That isn't nearly enough capacity to meet those needs. And so I think, the critical link is you have to build housing in order to bring down the cost of housing and in order to address some of those affordability concerns. And we have to be rezoning in ways that create additional room to grow, not downzone.
So there are people who are very unhappy in areas that have become more dense or, you know, in places like Williamsburg where a lot of luxury housing went up and people feel gentrified out of their own neighborhoods. So it's very tricky business.
It is a very tricky calculation because often the same neighborhoods that don't want additional density also want affordable housing for their kids, for their parents, but the two are inextricably linked.
Also in answer to the zoning question, Controller Lou mentioned something that I thought might get more of a conversation going than it did. Listen.
Mandatory inclusionary zoning would allow property owners and developers to make a profit. I'm not against anybody making profit, but I just don't want to give them the store like we gave them this past decade. I think a lot of the value can be reserved for the building of affordable housing and the associated infrastructure that we need with whole new neighborhoods throughout the city.
So, Professor Bean, mandatory inclusionary zoning, very wonky phrase. Does it mean basically whenever a developer puts up big market rate buildings, they would be required to include some affordable housing? 20% of the units is the most common number, I think?
Yes. So whenever they build to the maximum FAR, they then have to build some share of the units as affordable housing. So mandatory inclusionary zoning is a tricky subject because one of the most important issues about zoning is how flexible it is and how able you are to use the zoning as a tool in both good markets and down markets, and how able you are to use the zoning across different kinds of neighborhoods. So one issue about mandatory inclusionary zoning is that it's not very flexible, right? If the market has turned down and you're requiring developers to provide 20% affordable housing, you may get no housing at all, right? So that's, I think, the critical question that we didn't really, that the candidates didn't really get into.
Would I have heard a lot of disagreement if I had gone down the row, because I know Lou is trying to stake out more progressive-seeming positions than everybody on a lot of things. So when he says mandatory inclusionary zoning, if I had gone down the row there, according to your understanding, and asked the others, would I have heard yes or no to mandatory inclusionary zoning? Do you know?
I think that for most of them, you would have heard yes. I think you might have, for a few of them, gotten a recognition that there are some costs to mandatory inclusionary zoning, and it does involve a trade-off of flexibility, other goals. And so you might have gotten a little bit more nuance, but I think the basic position has been more in favor of mandatory inclusionary zoning.
And that brings us to the question of which New Yorkers affordable housing is for. You know, we get this call on the show all the time. We talk about affordable housing and people call in or tweet us or whatever and say, what does affordable housing mean? Affordable for whom? So we asked that question at the forum yesterday, and the response here from Adolfo Carrion was representative of the group.
There is an income band that we're not developing housing for that is falling off and possibly leaving the city.
And what is that band?
And that band would be that, 120% of area median income or 100% of area median.
What is that for
roughly? So it's somewhere above that $45,000, $50,000 range to about $80,000. These families have sort of no real place to land.
So that's where you would focus.
I think we need to have a balanced approach.
Now, that was really interesting to me, Professor Bean, and I didn't know what answer we were going to get. And then really nobody disagreed with him on what income band, the phrase he used, affordable housing needs to be focused on primarily. And I would not have guessed that it would have been $50,000 to $80,000. I thought these candidates probably would have said less. Are you surprised by that?
Well, I think that especially de Blasio did say – we need to focus on the lowest income group, which is not that income band that he was talking about. But I think the real difference there was in Speaker Quinn's emphasis on we need to address the needs of the middle income families who are not covered by federal dollars, right? So federal dollars are very much targeted towards those lower income groups. And she was arguing,
like people who can get Section 8 vouchers, people living in public housing, things like that.
Exactly, but also people at 60% of AMI as opposed to 120% of AMI. So, and there are some programs for that band around 120% of AMI, but most of the targeting is for those lower income groups. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of a difference between the candidates in terms of, I mean, people talked in terms of balance, et cetera, but I thought that Speaker Quinn really focused on the middle income band, for which there would have to be city dollars because the federal money just doesn't cover that band.
Now, Mayor Bloomberg has built or preserved close to 160,000 units of affordable housing. But we always hear that term, built or preserved. Is that a dodge because preserving affordable housing is merely holding the line while building it expands what's available?
Well, preserving is more than holding the line. First of all, it's an efficient way to make sure that housing stays affordable, right? The cost of preserving versus the cost of building new is very, very different. So most of these programs were designed that after 15 years or after 30 years, the owner would have the right to leave the subsidy program and to take those properties market rate. And so preserving is really finding new subsidies to keep them in the program.
Mm-hmm.
But those new subsidies are always cheaper than building new. So it's not a dodge. It's
mm-hmm.
Preservation is a critical piece of this, and if we just let everything that we've invested, those original subsidy dollars in, go market rate, we've lost an opportunity to keep that housing affordable at a much lower cost than building new.
My guest on WNYC is Professor Vicky Bean, B-E-E-N, director of the Furman Center at NYU, which studies affordable housing and which sponsored the mayoral candidates forum that I moderated for them yesterday at the NYU Tishman Auditorium. We're listening to some clips from that and talking about the candidates' positions and the policies involved. So since all the candidates want to build more affordable housing, I asked where the money would come from. One of the answers came from former controller Bill Thompson, with a reminder afterwards from current controller John Liu.
You're in a very unique climate right now where interest rates are at an incredible low. As, you know, older bonds are being refinanced, it frees up additional dollars. It is an opportunity that
okay.
should not be missed.
All right.
So, I mean, that's one thing right there. Where do you find additional dollars in the interest rate environment we're in right now? There's great opportunity there.
Speaker?
Three things. I agree this is a good opportunity to borrow, and we shouldn't miss that opportunity. Two, already the mayor and I have been looking at efficiencies in government. One example is we've improved the management of the city's vehicle, our fleet system. That's going to save us $87 million a year in capital starting next year. That's an example of money that could be repurposed.
Trello, you want to talk?
Just very briefly, I want to thank Chris and Bill for supporting my capital acceleration plan, which takes advantage of the low interest rates.
That was an endorsement, John.
Yes,
it is an endorsement. It's a good idea.
Yes.
Lots of people can have good ideas.
It's a good one.
So that was really interesting. Bill Thompson and obviously Speaker Christine Quinn and John Liu. Part of that was pension funds, I guess, Professor Bean, as a mechanism for investing in affordable housing. So what were they getting at there specifically, and what was it that John Liu seemed to rightly take credit for?
I think that the idea there is to really draw upon the city's pension fund dollars, the investments that are there, to provide more capital investment for the development of housing. So in many states, California, for example, the pension funds invest very heavily in financing subsidized housing, in making the loans that the developers need to build those subsidized housing projects. So basically his idea is let's tap into those pension fund dollars. Of course, those pension fund dollars have to be invested, have to earn a rate of return for their for the retirees, right? And that it has to be invested safely. But as I mentioned, many states have found that it is a good investment to invest in subsidized housing projects. So it just brings more capital to the table for investment in that kind of housing.
That's really interesting, because the mandate of a controller is to get the best returns on pension fund investments. I mean, we know pensions are in crisis, right? We need to get as much return on the pension investment dollar as we possibly can for all the future retirees. So the assumption here is that affordable housing produces those kinds of returns. Is that a sign of just how profitable real estate development is, that even affordable housing is likely to produce Wall Street-grade returns on their dollar?
Well, I think it's a sign of the safety of investment in housing in New York City, yes. And that's both for affordable and for market rate. Housing is a safe investment in New York City, given the strength of our real estate market.
All right. Well, another topic that came up, NYCHA, the city's public housing authority, proposing to sell some land to developers for market rate housing on the same grounds. This drew some skepticism from Bill de Blasio, but an endorsement from Carrion. They both have worked in the Housing and Urban Development Department in Washington. Here's de Blasio.
Well, I think the cynicism about the proposal is well placed, because, you know, there's been a rush in the last year or two of the Bloomberg administration to privatize public assets and contract out and close schools. So I don't blame anybody, a NYCHA tenant or anyone, who thinks it might turn into privatization.
Right. But Carrion insisted this would not mean privatization of the current public housing units.
NYCHA has a gigantic capital hole, just like housing authorities all across this country. It is virtually impossible for them to fill it unless we get creative. There is not necessarily a conflict between what some people have called privatization incorrectly, but selling the assets or the development rights and creating affordable housing. It doesn't have to be one against the other.
Another public housing question was about so-called overhousing. Many thousands of seniors living in family-size apartments, now bigger than they need, while many thousands of families currently with children are on waiting lists. Here is former Councilman Sal Albanese's answer to that.
We also need living wage jobs. Many of these people that are in overhoused apartments work in jobs that are not a living wage for New York City. I passed the city's first living wage law back in 1996. The housing issue is tied to living wage jobs in New York City.
Albanese on moving seniors out of two large public housing units. We also asked a few questions about homelessness. One had to do with whether people living in homeless shelters should get priority for permanent affordable housing. There are often accusations that that allows some poor people to jump the line by moving into a shelter for a while. Bill Thompson's response to that, in no uncertain terms.
The only people who talk about that happening are those who never have gone to a homeless shelter. If you go to a homeless shelter, make one visit, you're not going back again. So no, people aren't doing that to jump the line.
And Speaker Quinn talking about subsidies to people who are currently homeless who need permanent housing.
We need to put a subsidy program back in place, not Advantage, a subsidy program that is structured to work and succeed, that will give folks a much greater exit door out of shelter.
All right. So was that a Bloomberg position to your understanding, Professor Bean? I think one of the candidates had mentioned, oh, Mayor Bloomberg says people purposely go into shelters to jump the line for permanent housing. Are you familiar with the controversy?
Yes. I mean, there is a lot of controversy about whether people essentially game their application to get to the front of a voucher waiting list, which is now about 120,000 people, or to get one of the very limited number of units that come available in NYCHA housing or in subsidized housing. So the controversy is always over whether people go into shelters in order to jump the line. The question is how you prove that. Many people argue that people who are turned away from the shelters on the ground that they have someplace else to stay, to double up with family, that kind of thing, end up finally coming back into the shelter, really having, you know, having no place else to go and having a doubled up or a tripled up situation being unsustainable in the long run. So they end up going into being showing that they really do need permanent housing and that they're not just gaming the system.
So I thought yesterday's event was, in the big picture, a very interesting discussion of housing policy nuances. I'm not sure that we heard much distinguishing of one candidate from another. You know, the other mayoral candidate forum that I moderated was on a bigger picture of poverty-related issues and on minimum wage, on paid sick leave before that compromise, on a number of other things. We heard candidates incredulous about the other candidates' positions. We heard, oh, I'm going to be much different on this because I XYZ. It seemed to me that we heard six candidates yesterday, five Democrats and carry on from the Independence Party line, who would be fairly similar in their approach. I wonder if you agree.
Well, I think that there are there aren't stark differences in the actual proposals at a very abstract or general level, but I think there were some differences in approach. So, for example, carry on came across as much more free market oriented, much more willing to and saw the importance of working with the private development community.
And that's the way he's running in general.
Right. And whereas Lou and de Blasio are much more focused on driving a hard bargain with developers, getting more from the developers, not leaving money on the table. You saw differences in terms of their willingness to really grapple with the nuance and the hard choices that have to be made. So when there was discussion, for example, about permanent affordability, some of the candidates were, you know, grappled much more with the problem of, okay, if you maintain it as affordable permanently, where's the money going to come from to maintain it? Where's the money going to come from to rehab it? Is that going to cost us more? Is it going to mean that we build fewer units? They, you know, some candidates see more of the nuance and more of the trade-offs and hard choices that have to be made than some of the other candidates do.
Vicky Bean, director of the Furman Center and the Mollis Institute for the Study of Affordable Housing at NYU, and she helped put together the questions for yesterday's Affordable Housing Forum among six of the mayoral candidates in New York City. Thank you so much for doing that. It was a fascinating experience to be involved with. I learned a lot, and thanks for coming on and talking through the clips with us.
Thank you for being a great moderator.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Adam Alter, author of Drunk Tank Pink, about how color and other unexpected forces shape how we think, feel, and behave. Stay with us.